Okay, we're discussing Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. And this is the meeting between Achia HaShiloni, the Navi, and Yerubim ben Nevat, destined to be the king. And the Navi says, Katcha Asar Kram Ki Ko Amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Hine Kareyas Amam Lochem Yad Shlomo, I'm going to tear the kingdom away from Shlomo, V'nasati Lucha, and I will give it to you, Esa Seres HaShvata. We discuss various aspects of this discussion, and of the Nevuah, but Pasuk Lamed Aleph presents a problem. The words say, take these 10 torn pieces of the garment, because I am tearing the Melucha away from who? From Shlomo. Yet, a few Pesukim later, we're going to be told that it's not going to be taken away from Shlomo. Only in the days of his son. So it should have said, Mi Beis Shlomo, B'nei Shlomo. What do you mean, Mi Shlomo? The kingdom is being taken away from Shlomo. So the there is a, I guess on a simple level, one could perhaps explain it. We do find this type of expression throughout Tanakh, that when a Kadosh Baruch Hu talks about something in the future, he speaks in present or past tense. Because when a Kadosh Baruch Hu decides something, it's done. When a human being says, I'm going to do something in the future, we still have to wait and see. You know, what may happen? He may change his mind, he may try to do it and not succeed, circumstances could intervene. So there's a difference between the future and the present. But with a Kadosh Baruch Hu, it doesn't work like that. So a Kadosh Baruch Hu decides something, it's done already. So in the it could be interpreted to mean, I've already done it, the decree has been set, there's no turning back, and I've taken the Melucha, but it doesn't actually happen in the physical world until the days of Rechabam, of Shlomo's son. Kli Yakar makes a very interesting diuk. Kli Yakar is quite amazing in what he picks up from the Lashonos of the Pesukim. If you'll note in this pasuk, the term used when the Navi says, I'm going to take the kingdom away, tear the kingdom away from Shlomo, is Mamlocha. If you go a few Pesukim further, Pasuk Lamed Dalet, also referring to Shlomo, Lo Akach is called Hamamlocha. But if you look in Pasuk Lamed Hey, where we're just talking about Shlomo's son, Rechavam, V'lokachti HaMelucha. So in reference to Shlomo, we find the expression Mamlocha. In reference to Shlomo's son, we find the expression Melucha. What is the difference between Mamlocha and Melucha? Says the Kli Yakar, Mamlocha doesn't refer to the political control. Mamlocha refers to royalty, to be regal, to have power, prestige, kavod, malchus. Mamlocha means that it's a chashuv of melucha. So he says that was already taken away in the days of Shlomo. Even before Shlomo died, and even before Rechavim took over, Shlomo's prestige and power and influence and the awe and the that he had over the people was reduced. So Hashem already took away the mamlocha miyad Shlomo, but the melucha, which meant the actual political power, that was not removed until the time of Shlomo's son. So and he goes on to explain. It's an interesting thing. I don't think he bases this on the pasuk, only on perhaps Svara, but he says that it could very well be that the reason, the way it worked, was that people also, the Klal Yisrael, began to realize some of the shortcomings of Shlomo, that what his wives were doing and how he failed to stop it. And therefore, the loyalty and respect that they had for Shlomo was reduced. They weren't going to do anything. After all, Shlomo had already served for a long time with great distinction. So nobody was ready to do anything in the lifetime of Shlomo. But the attitude that they had towards Shlomo had already changed because of these actions. So the Kli Yakar suggests that the mamlocha, the royalty, the regal splendor, the power, the prestige, that was already taken away in the days of Shlomo to a certain extent. The melucha, the political control, the actual rulership, that waited until Shlomo's son. Now there's another implication in this pasuk that has certain ramifications, perhaps lahalacha, at least to understand it, is the implication in this pasuk is, I'm giving it to you. It seems that Yerubim is being given what Shlomo had. Pasuk Lamed Hey, similarly, and I'll give it to you. If you look ahead in Pasuk Lamed Zayin, I will take you, it seems from all these psukim that Yerubim's status was similar to the status of Malchus Beis David, that he was a king. Not identical, we know there are differences, we'll discuss some of them in a few moments. But he was really a king. He had the status and halach of a king, and there are nafkaminas of being a king. For example, is there a din of morid b'malchus? If somebody does not listen, defies the king's orders, disrespectful to the king, so he's a morid b'malchus, he could be executed without the benefit of a trial before Sanhedrin, and his property goes to the king. Does that status apply to Yerubim ben Nevat and to the Malchus Yisrael? So the implication of these psukim is that it does, and it's a little bit puzzling. Where does this come from? So the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim says, Navi Shehemid Melech, I can't read what I wrote, Mishar Shvatim, Navi Shehemid Melech Mishar Shvatim, has the din of a king. So the Rambam on its surface seems to be addressing this question, that Yerubim ben Nevat is accorded the status of a melech. The reason is because he's appointed by a Navi. Som tasi melech ha-melech mikrev achecha doesn't say based on it. So if it's done with the consent and with the authority of a Navi, then he has a din of a melech. The implication of the Rambam would be that if it was not done by a Navi, then you would not have the din of a melech. This contradicts a Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi says that all the kings of Yisrael until Yehu had the din of a melech. From Yehu and on, the kings in that tekufa achieved the throne by force, by killing, by coups, by revolutions, just like the Goyim. It's interesting. Rabbi Chanan suggests that amongst the Goyim, that works. In the Roman Empire, that's what happened all the time. They were killing each other, poisoning, killing, whatever it was. You know, being an emperor of Rome was not a recipe for longevity, with very few exceptions. There were a few. One notable exception was Marcus Aurelius, who in the Gemara is known as Antoninus, who is the friend of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. This is one of the elements of Siyata Deshmaya that people have pointed out, Rabbi Victor Miller talks about in his history books. Actually, it's interesting because the Gemara and the Midrashim have many discussions and many stories about the relationship between Rabbi and Antoninus. And
became a gift.
What?
Became a gift.
I don't know about that, but I don't think so. He wanted to, but Rebbe told him no. So that that Antoninus, and then the next king, Commodus, was also friendly to the Jews, but they had a long relationship, and there was no such Antoninus in that time in Roman history. So historians, used to make fun of the Talmudic account. Who's this Antoninus that you're talking about? Until they discovered an old manuscript of Marcus Aurelius' book. He wrote a philosophical book, and on the title page it said Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. So the Romans knew him primarily by his first names, and apparently the Jews knew him primarily by his last name. So that was Marcus Aurelius, and then so he lived a little bit longer than the average emperor and happened to be friendly to the Jews, as was Commodus, his successor, which enabled the Mishnayos to be written. When the Mishnayos was collected, they had to gather the Talmid HaChachamim together under the periods of oppression that preceded this and followed it. That was impossible. You couldn't get these big assemblies of all the Tanoim together. They'd be killed. You had to go into small groups and corners. It couldn't be done. Somehow, all of a sudden, we have friendly emperors in Rome. For enough time, to be able to compile the Mishnah. Then it goes back to business as usual, all the anti-Semites and the persecutors and so on. So this was clearly Hashgacha min Hashemayim, enabled us to have the Mishnayos. But with very few exceptions, the Roman kings were generally killed by friends, enemies, family, whoever it may be. So unfortunately, maybe not to the extent of the Romans, but this began to happen in the time of Yehoanan. So those kings who assumed power by force, at least amongst Klal Yisrael, do not have the din of a king. That's what the Yerushalmi says. Rabbi Chanan suggests that amongst Goyim, they maybe do. But the question is, between Yeravam and Yehu, there were a number of kings, and they were not appointed by a Navi. So how do they have the din of a king? So the Radvaz says that there's a second route to becoming a king and having legitimacy as a king. You could be appointed by a Navi, but if you don't happen to have that, the second legitimate route to Malchus is to be accepted by the people. This is about the closest that we come to democracy in Tanakh. But if the people accept him as the king, then he becomes a king. So until Yehu, the kings of Yisrael were accepted by Yisrael. From Yehu and on, they were not. They simply were dictators who achieved power by force, and therefore did not have the status in halacha of a king. What is the difference then, if Yeravam ben Nevat and the Malchei Yisrael, at least the early Malchei Yisrael, were kings, what is the difference between their status and Malchus Beis David? So there are several things. One, the one that features prominently in the history of Klal Yisrael, we've mentioned this several times, was that in the Azara and the Beis HaMikdash, only Malchus Beis David, a king from Beis David, was allowed to sit. Everybody else, including a king from Yisrael, had to stand. This halacha had unfortunate consequences because this led to the chait, essentially, of Yeravam ben Nevat. When he became king, he was very concerned if Klal Yisrael continued to be Olah Regel, they would see the difference in honor accorded to Malchus Beis David and him. If he were not to go and be Olah Regel, everyone else did, that looks bad. Why aren't you being Olah Regel? But if he did go, then he would have to stand in the Azara while Rechabim was sitting. So rather than subject himself to being treated as a second-class citizen, or second-class king, he wasn't saying all the citizens had to stand, but he was a second-class king, he prohibited Klal Yisrael from going to be Olah Regel, and he instead instituted other forms of service, which were either Avodah Zarah, Leta Avodah Zarah, and that was the downfall of Yeravam ben Nevat. So, but this is one difference between Malchus Beis David and Malchus Yisrael. Another difference that the Gemara says is that Malchus Beis David is permanent, any other form of Malucha is temporary. This is not as simple as it seems. If you look a little bit ahead, we'll take a sneak preview. Pasuk Lamed Ches. But this is only a preview. We reserve the right to revisit the Pasuk when we get there. So the Pasuk says, V'hayim tishma es kol asher atzavecha, v'alachta bedrachai, if you listen to all I command you and go on my ways, Hashem, of course this isn't spoken in the name of Hashem, v'asisha yosher be'enai, and you do what's right in my eyes, lishma chukosai mitzvasa kasher asa David avdi, v'ayisi imach, I will be with you, v'anislecha bayis neman, I will build you a faithful house, kasher banisi l'David, as I built for David, v'nasati l'cha es Yisrael, and I will give you control over Yisrael. So it sounds that Yeravam is being given a option if he follows the Torah and listens to the Tzivuyim of Hashem and does Yashar Ve'enav, then he will have the same type of bias in Yisrael as David had in Yehuda. That implies that he would be able to be Marish Melucha to his children and would go on. Now it's true that Yeravam did sin and this didn't happen. But that's not inherent in Malchus Yisrael. How could you say that Malchus Yisrael is temporary and Malchus Beis David is permanent? It happened to be, it turned out that it was temporary. That was because of Yeravam's sins. But because Yeravam told him if he didn't sin, he would have a bias Neman like David did.
Does that mean he'd be able to sit in there though?
No. That's something else. That's a different halacha. So there are a number of explanations to attempt to explain this. Yes. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer said in Devin Ezel that the difference is that Malchus based David, even if they sin, they still end up getting it back. So even though Malchus based David also ended up sinning and they lost the Malucha, but Yemos HaMashiach, they're going to get it back. So the Malchus based David is permanent. No matter what they do, they may lose it for a period of time, but it will always come back to them. Malchus Yisrael is different, because if Malchus Yisrael sins, they lose it and they don't get it back. So once Yeravim and his family lost the Malucha, it didn't come back to them. And the same thing is true with the other Malchus Yisrael. So that's what we mean when we say that Malchus Beis David is permanent. It doesn't mean that Malchus Beis David is continuous, and neither is Malchus Yisrael continuous. But the difference is that Malchus Yisrael, if they lose it, they never get it back. Malchus Beis David, if they lose it, they do get it back. In a similar way, this is really built on a Migdal Oz, who may or may not mean exactly what the Ibn Ezra says. The Migdal Oz says that Malchus Beis David retains the Malucha even if they sin. Now, it's not clear if he means this, that they get it back later, or if he means even while they're sinning, because we do find that amongst Malchus Yisrael, when they sinned, they lost the Malucha immediately, went to a different family. Sometimes it went one or two generations. But in Malchus Beis David, there were sinful kings, and they remained kings until the Churban. Sometimes you had several generations in a row of Chotim. So the power of chait does not affect Malchus Beis David in the same way that it affects Malchus Yisrael. But had he not sinned, in the Chanami, he could have remained permanent. The Ravid does not like these pshatim. Presumably, the problem is because when we say that the Malchus isn't permanent, the idea to say that it's based on chait doesn't seem, has its difficulties. Let's put it that way, because you can't predict chait, even though we know that people sin, but you can't say the Malucha is not permanent because you're certainly going to sin. Every king has bechira, every king has choice, and at least the hypothetical possibility exists that Malchus Yisrael will never sin. So how could a pasuk say how can you learn from Sukkim that it's not permanent? So to base it on the historical fact that they did sin is okay, that's fine, but does not justify a statement from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that it's not permanent. Wherever they're medayik from, the David will be Malach Olam, only David and not Yisrael. You can't say that because you're predicting something that's totally in Bechira, it's totally in choice. So what the Ravid says is that it's Taka is no guarantee to Yeravam that he would be king or his descendants will be king forever. That's not the answer. That's the problem.
No, not kol hayamim, which means that David will be back.
Yeah, that is true. Right, but the question is that how could you promise that you're going to have a bias neman?
This is Israel. You will come. But you said, I will not.
But it's a contradiction. You're telling me if I keep all the mitzvahs, then you're going to have a bias neman to David. And then you're going to say, but David's going to come back. You can't predict that I'm not going to keep the mitzvahs. So the Ravid says that it never says in the pasuk that Yeravam will be king forever. It says bias neman. Bias does not have to be a king. So had Yeravam not sinned, then his household and his children, not sin, his household would have always had a prominent position in Klal Yisrael. Maybe they would have been the viceroys. They would have been a Mishnah Lamelech. Or the Lashon that the Ravid uses is Malka Plag Malka. The Gemara talks about an expression, a king and a half king. Half king is like the viceroy, the king's minister. So he would have had a bias neman, he would have always had a position of leadership and prominence, but he wouldn't have been the number one person. The number one person is Achlo Kol Yom. Sooner or later, David's going to get back into that position, based on it. But had Yeravam not sinned, he would have been right up there. He would have been in the inner council. His descendants, they would have been the viceroys of the king.
Shiva?
Yes.
Would Shaul have been in the same situation if he didn't sin?
I don't know. We don't have such a statement by Shaul. I'm not sure what we have by Shaul. I didn't learn Shmuel. We're only doing Malacha.
There's one of the Sadiq in his own right too, right?
What? Shaul himself was a tzaddik. Shaul did not die in Russia. Right? It says, Machar Tomim Chitzasi, he was in the same section of Gan Eden as Shmuel Hanavi. So Shaul, with all his shortcomings, did not die in Russia. He died a tzaddik, unlike Yeravim ben Nevat. But I guess he was never given promise of permanence.
What level of cheder are we talking about?
By Yeravim?
Yeah.
Very serious.
It's a lower level of chatayim.
We'll get to it in Mirza Shad.
As far as keeping a bias neman.
Oh, this I don't know, but what he ended up doing was pretty serious. There is another difference. This is mentioned in Yerushalmi. Another difference between Malchus Beis David and Malchus Yisrael, it's alluded to also in the pasuk coming up soon, is that only Malchus Beis David is a melech in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim has a certain status, and a melech from Yisrael is not a king in Yerushalayim. He's a commoner. Rab Velvel uses this to explain a difficult Gemara. The Gemara itself is easy enough, but the phraseology of the Gemara is different. It's difficult. The Gemara says, when Yeravim was contemplating his dilemma about being Ole Regal, so he said to himself, what am I going to do? If I stand, then I'm going to look like I'm not a king, that he's superior to me. If I sit, I will be a Moreid B'Malchus, and I'll be killed. So the only thing I could do is stop them from being Ole Regal. So the argument that if I stand, I look second rate, and if I sin, I violate the Avera of sinning in Nazara. Okay, but what do you mean a Moreid B'Malchus? How is he a Moreid B'Malchus? If a person comes and sits in Nazara, is he a Moreid B'Malchus? He's being violating an Avera. What makes it a Moreid B'Malchus?
Behaving like that status.
All right, but it's, you know, there could be other reasons for sitting. He's a king too, don't forget. So you can't call him a Moreid B'Malchus. A Moreid B'Malchus is somebody who's subject to a king. If a commoner sat, maybe you can make that argument. Who do you think you are? You're the king? But I am a king. I'm a king who doesn't have permission to sit. Okay, so I violated that issur. I'm a rebel? What do you mean a rebel? I'm not subservient to you in the first place. If Rechavim would have given a command to Yeravim, and Yeravim refused to listen, would that make him a Moreid B'Malchus? Not a Moreid B'Malchus. You're not my king. I'm an equal to you. Or just that if I gave you a command and Rechavim doesn't listen, he wouldn't be a Moreid B'Malchus either. So how could he be a Moreid B'Malchus if he's a king as well? So Rav Velvel says very simple. He's a king, but not in Yerushalayim. In Yerushalayim, he's a commoner. And he is a subject of Rechavim. And Rechavim gives him a command in Yerushalayim, he's mechuyav to listen to it. And therefore, if he sits in front of Rechavim in Yerushalayim and acts like a king, he's a Moreid B'Malchus. So there's a unique status to the city of Yerushalayim, and on that, there's specifically the Melucha was given to Malchus Beis David, and this is actually stated, we'll get to the Pasuk shortly, in Pasuk Lamed Hey. I'm sorry, not Pasuk Lamed Hey. Pasuk Lamed Vav, where it stated Hashem gave Shevet Echad, and then specifically a specific statement, Laman is near L'David Avdi Kalim L'Fanim B'Yerushalayim. So besides the fact that Yerushalayim was in the Shevet that Rechavim was ruling, but besides that, there's a specific Melucha in Yerushalayim. Then Yerushalayim, you are the king, everyone else is a commoner. So therefore, Yeravim knew that in Yerushalayim itself he would have the din of Amar B'Malchus, and not simply violating the Isser of being Yoshev Bazara. So he didn't want to do that. Yes?
By commoner, do you mean that he's different than other foreign kings? That, like a diplomat?
I don't know what the foreign king's status was. I assume they weren't allowed to sit in Azara either, but I don't know.
And do you mean commoner, or is it like he's just like everyone else?
Right.
He doesn't
have the status of a king. And normally, as we would say, that you can't call Yeravim a Moreid B'Malchus for not listening to Rechavim when Rechavim is not his king. But in Yerushalayim, you could call him Amar ben Malchus, because in Yerushalayim, Rechavim is your king. Which makes it actually a little bit even more understandable, Yerushalayim's dilemma. Obviously, he didn't handle it right. But Yerushalayim's dilemma, it wasn't only that in Yerushalayim, he would be a second-class king. He would just be a commoner. He would have to listen to Rechavim. He would be... So people look at him, you're a king? You're kafuf, you're subservient to Rechavim. And he didn't want that to undermine his own malucha.
The status of Yerushalayim, and any king would have had that issue.
All right.
Not so terrible, right?
Okay, but still. So, I'm not justifying Yerushalayim. I'm just saying what was playing in his mind, what the problem that he was struggling with. Okay, let's take a look at Pasuk Lamed Beis. Pasuk Lamed Beis. Shevet Echad Yelo. One Shevet will be for him, meaning Shlomo and his descendants. Lama, we mentioned before, there was actually two Shvatim. It was Yehuda and Binyamin. But Binyamin was always connected to Yehuda. There are various other reasons why he wasn't counted separately. Vashevet echad yelo, leman avdi David, for the sake of my servant David, leman Yerushalayim, for the sake of Yerushalayim, ir asher bacharti ba, the city that I have chosen, mikol shiftei Yisrael, from all the tribes of Israel. Now this presents a difficulty. What, I think we might have mentioned this before, I don't recall for sure. I had a recollection we did, but I didn't, skimming through my notes, I didn't see it. But I may have seen it before and not said it, so I'm not sure. But if I'm repeating myself, so be it. What does it mean when we say for the sake of Yerushalayim? Why is it to the benefit of Yerushalayim to have David as the king, as opposed to David as the king, as opposed to having another king? And as I'm leaving over one Shevet for the sake of David, fine, that I understand. Because Hashem promised David the Melucha, because of the great Schusim of David, so his descendants retained the Shevet or Tushvatim, whatever it was, even though perhaps they didn't really deserve it, Mishuras Adin. So Laman David, I'm giving them that Melucha. But why is it Laman Yerushalayim? In what way is it for the sake of Yerushalayim that Beis David should retain the Melucha? So the Kli Yakar gives two reasons. One reason he says is that Lamaisa, Malchus Beis David, was superior to Malchus Yisrael. If you go through the doors, although there were some terrible Rishonim amongst the Malchus Beis David as well, but there were also great Tzaddikim. And you go through the generations, there was Asa and Yehoshaphat and Chizkiyahu and Tzidkiyahu. So there were a number of righteous kings amongst the Malchus Beis David. You didn't really have that amongst the Malchus Yisrael. There were some who were less bad than others, but none of them merited the title of a Tzaddik. So therefore, it was for the benefit of Yerushalayim to be ruled by Beis David and have a more spiritual, for the most part, higher level of rulership than would have happened under Malchus Yisrael. A second reason is kind of interesting. He says that Lamaisa, it was David and Shlomo who built the Beis HaMikdash and built up Yerushalayim. So a king who is from their family will be more motivated to uphold Yerushalayim and defend it than a king from Beis Yisrael. So this familial connection will motivate them to be moser nefesh more for the sake of Yerushalayim. I suppose today, you know, people are talking about giving parts of Yerushalayim back. We would have to assume that those people who are saying that are probably not descendants of Beis David. But when you have that family connection, it adds more. Now, if you stop to think about it, this is an interesting circumstance. You, even without being a member of David and Shlomo's family, there are plenty of reasons to defend Yerushalayim. You have the Beis HaMikdash, which besides anything else was just a splendorous, tremendous, impressive achievement. A tremendous kavod, tremendous beauty, not to mention the kapara that one could achieve through the Beis HaMikdash, the presence of the Shechina. Beis HaMikdash is a very focal, central point. Even when Klal Yisrael sinned, they still had a focus on the Beis HaMikdash. They thought the Beis HaMikdash would protect them. And they have various nevuahs. We alluded to them in the mentioned them in the past. Because Baruch had to tell them, don't rely on the Beis HaMikdash. So the Beis HaMikdash was a tremendous thing. Just so even if you're not from Beis David, wouldn't you want to defend the Beis HaMikdash? And Bechlal, it's your capital city. You're under attack from enemies. You just give up. Right? Every country defends themselves, and they certainly defend their capital city. So with all the motivations that any melech would have to defend the Beis HaMikdash and defend his capital city, but there's something extra, because my great-great-grandfather built this Beis HaMikdash. My great-great-grandfather made the city, built the city. So you feel that natural family loyalty is a powerful enough force that it registers even in the light of other extremely powerful forces. It's nothing to be sneezed at. And there's a, you know, that's human nature. And with all the motivation that a king would have to fight for his country and to protect his own capital and to fight for the Beis HaMikdash and the Shechina and the Karbanos and the beauty and the splendor and everything else. But there comes a certain point in time that he's pushed himself as hard as he can and he might give up. Whereas somebody who feels like it's my family's legacy will push himself that much harder. So there is something to be said about maintaining a family legacy. I heard a similar idea from the Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal. The Gemara tells us that the Kohen Gadol, when he did the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash on Yom Kippur, so there's a whole procedure, you know, for 7 days he was preparing, and the night of Yom Kippur, they kept him up the entire night, so that there shouldn't be any possibility of accidentally becoming Tameh. And to keep him up, they had people reading to him parts of Tanakh. So one of the selections that was read was Sefer Ezra. Why? Because Ezra dictates, talks about the tremendous poverty Kal Yisrael suffered in the Mesiris Nefesh and the difficulties they had in building the Beis HaMikdash. And he would say, the Kohen Gadol would say, my ancestors were Moser Nefesh, went through so much trouble to build this Beis HaMikdash, it's my responsibility to treat it properly and to make sure that I do the Avodah properly. Now again, one would think that the Kohen Gadol had pretty sufficient reason to want to do all the Avodah properly anyway. First of all, it's Yom Kippur. Who doesn't get a certain Yisaros when it comes to Yom Kippur? And not only Stam Yom Kippur, you're going into the Kodesh HaKodashim. What an opportunity, what a privilege. And who would appreciate that more than the Kohen Gadol, who was involved, his whole life was involved with the Beis HaMikdash, Avodah, they're the guardians of the Beis HaMikdash. So certainly he's approaching the Beis HaMikdash with awe and reverence. And besides, there's a very practical reason. When the Kohen Gadol went into the Beis HaMikdash, they tied a rope around his waist. Because he went into the Kodesh HaKodashim and did something improper, he was likely to die, and then they needed to drag his body out because they couldn't go into the Kodesh HaKodashim. So they're tying this rope around your waist. You understand that if you do something wrong, you're going to die. And you probably know this because last year's Kohen Gadol is dead. Right? The Chazal tell us during the second Beis HaMikdash there was quite a turnover rate amongst the Kohanim and Gedolim. So one would think that that would be a pretty strong motivation to try to do everything properly. And yet, but if you remind yourself the night before your ancestors, you know, suffered to build this Beis HaMikdash, then it adds a little bit more motivation. That's human nature, you know. There's something there's no such thing as maxing out. As motivated as we may be, but you know, there's always makom for hisrashlus, for laziness, for failing to get up off the floor and push. It's not so easy. I mean, again, you know, life is like that in general. Whatever motivation we can muster for a good cause, we should do so. Don't think we shouldn't rely on the fact that we're ready to do it. You have to think and focus why we're doing it, to have as much motivation as possible, because there's going to be things that knock you down. You got to pick yourself up and keep going. There's a saying out there that says, falling down is not failure. Not getting up is failure. It says, people fall down, they get knocked down, but you have to get up. Sheva yipot tzadik become. Tzadik can fall 7 times, but he gets up. You only fail when you don't get up. But it's not so easy. At a certain point in time, people don't get up. So you have to have that extra motivation. No such thing as enough motivation. So the fact that you add this tzir, look what my ancestors went through to build the Beis HaMikdash. The fact that you add this thing, it's my great-grandfather who built it. It makes a difference. And when the going gets tough, and things are difficult, that could make a difference in terms of how you defend it. So it's to the benefit, getting back to the Pasuk, it is to the benefit of Yerushalayim itself to have a king from Beis David, because a king from Beis David is likely to be more motivated than another king. As motivated as the other king might be, but the king from Beis David will be more motivated. Now another diuk on this pasuk. We say, Laman Avdi David, Laman Yerushalayim, Ha'ir Asher Bacharti Ba. And then it says, Mikol Shifte Yisrael. That seems like an unnecessary phrase. It's a city I've chosen. Obviously it's chosen from Shifte Yisrael. Where else is it chosen from? And Mefarshim point out that the status of Yerushalayim is unique in Halacha. Yerushalayim is not really considered to be part of private ownership of any particular Shevet. Yerushalayim is Mikol Shifte Yisrael. And there are various different halachic, potential halachic nafkaminas, you know, in terms of the rights of the Oli Regal, you know, to sleep in Yerushalayim, whether they can be charged for it, they can't be charged for it, in terms of being Makdish, you know, property in Yerushalayim, and whether they could become Hekdish, whether they could be redeemed. But there are halachic ramifications of the fact that Yerushalayim is, so to speak, above and beyond the normal Yerusha of Eretz Yisrael. It is a common area belonging to all of Klal Yisrael. And that's what it means, B'chadu HaShivtei Yisrael. And the reason why it's mentioned this pasuk is to imply, to point out a certain aspect, that although the Melucha was taken away from Beis David and only retained on the two Shvatim, at some level, Beis David still remained the king of all of Klal Yisrael. And at some level, the original gift to David was still maintained, even though the gift was conditional. And that if your descendants sinned, the Melucha could be lost, and that's what happened. Nevertheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Mekayim b'miktsaso, to some degree, his gift to David, despite the fact that the condition was not fulfilled. In what way? Since the Beis David remained king of Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim was a communal city, Mikol Shiftei Yisrael. So the rulership of Beis David on Yerushalayim, in a way, was a form of rulership on all of Klal Yisrael. So in that sense, something was retained of the Melucha and Klal Yisrael. It's a little bit of an insight into the Midos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Of course, we know this from other sources that the Chesed of HaKadosh Baruch Hu outweighs the Din. And, you know, even when something has to be taken away, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't take it away fully. Even when we deserve to lose, somehow something is not. HaKadosh Baruch Hu still allows some kind of a, albeit on a much reduced scale, something of what they originally had. So this is part of the Chazay Hashem. So Yerushalayim you get, it's Kol Shiftei Yisrael, so you have a Yad, a Melucha, something to do with the rest of Klal Yisrael. Pasuk Lamed Gimel, why is this happening? Ya'an Asher Azavuni, because you have left me. Vayishtachavu la'ashteros, and they bowed to Ashteros, Elahed Sidonim, which was the god of the Sidonim, L'chmosh Elahed Moab, and to Chmosh, the god of Moab, Ule Milkom Elahed B'nei Ammon, and to Milkom, the god of Ammon, L'holchu B'drachai, they did not go in my ways, La'asos ha'yosher b'enai, to do what's right in my eyes, V'chukosayu mishpatayim, my chokim and mishpatim, kidavid aviv, like David his father. Now who are we talking about here? We're talking about Shlomo. What is this? Vayishtachavu, plural, they, bowed l'ashtaros. How many people were Shlomo?
What?
Ah, correct. And so the Kli Yakar points out that the Lashon of the Pasuk reinforces that which we said before, Alpi Chazal, that Shlomo really didn't do any of these things. That Shlomo's guilt was in preventing his wives from doing it. Until Pasuk Lamed Gimel, we're talking in Lashon Yachid. Vashevet Echad Yeh Lo. He will get one Shevet. afterwards, in Pasuk Lamed Dalet, V'lo Ekach Es Kol Melachah Miyado. David Aviv, his father David. This is all Lashon Yachid. In the middle, we're talking plural. Azavuni Vayishtachavu. So what has happened is, what the Pasuk is saying is, you know what Shlomo did wrong? His wives bowed down to Avodah Zarah. That was Shlomo's chait. So that's why it converts from, and of course, as we were medayik in the earlier Pasuk, therefore the taina was, he didn't follow the ways of David. If he himself was serving Avodah Zarah, that's a lot worse than not following the ways of David. Right? David was a tzaddik yisod olam, the greatest of the great, and here's this guy who's serving Avodah Zarah. I said, well, you know, you didn't meet David's standards. So this is what happened. He really wasn't serving Avodah Zarah, well, not even close. But he wasn't sufficiently being mashgiach on his thousand wives and production or whatever it was. And he didn't, at least when he got older. And he wasn't able to stop them. And that was the problem. And maybe it was his fault for marrying so many wives, as we said before, and the various things that led to it. Yes?
Does a man have so much power over his wives to be able to control?
Well, maybe when you're the king, you do. I'm not sure every regular private citizen does. But
he said because I mean
it may be that David's chait was in marrying so many wives in the first place. Shlomo's chait. Marrying so many wives in the first place in such a way that you can't exert control. But it seems we mentioned the psukim before that this only happened when Shlomo was older. So when he was younger, he did manage to control them. But when he's older, you know, it was a little bit harder for him. He eased off, and this is what happened. But the chait of Shlomo was not that he himself served Avodah Zarah, chas v'shalom, but that it happened under his watch. And he wasn't sufficiently on top of things to prevent it. Okay, we'll stop here.